Dave, you don't care how much stall margin you have here because you're not going to increase angle of attack. You're not going to cut into that margin at all. But we know that pilots do often in this situation pull too much and stall the airplane or skid and end up in the base to final spin scenario that we all hear about. And that's even without the pressure of this traffic on the opposing base, right? I'm wondering if it's realistic to expect that the lower time pilot in this scenario will have the good stick and rudder instincts under pressure here, or should someone with that level of experience simplify the actual maneuvering here, just level the wings and climb straight ahead? Is it different for you versus maybe a less experienced pilot in this situation?
I think this pilot is up to it. He's just finished a checkout in this airplane in which stalls and slow flight have been part of the curriculum. So if anyone has got recent experience flying close to the margins, it's this pilot. I think there's sufficient margin, and I think that, strangely, the bank angle that he's already in actually helps, because as he powers up and the nose rises, that actually just pulls him around in the turn like he wants to go anyway. So I don't think that it's going to require any extraordinary stick and rudder skill in this situation to execute the go-around.
Richard.
So I would add, there is a base level concept here, I think, that helps, and it's a ladder of priorities, right? And that is, whenever you get in a tight scenario or something's not quite going like you want it, make sure you have flying airspeed and a clear flight path. Those two things. Focus on those two things, and this scenario gives you a couple different options where you can do that. You may favor one over the other, but make sure you keep flying airspeed with your power and the way you're handling the wing, and clear your flight path. And the rest of it, that sort of simplistic model to me helps here.
Sarah.
So there's two unique threats in this scenario that are really important to the pilot at this time. You have the threat of a mid-air collision, which is why they don't want to overshoot in the first place. And then you have the threat of getting into your stall spin scenario. And I think that out of those two, the priority should be to avoid that stall spin scenario, because it's a large sky. You can probably miss the other traffic. Additionally, with that southern wind, that's probably one of the reasons why they're potentially overshooting that base to final turn. So even if you try to climb on runway heading, there's a chance that they might overshoot anyway at that point. So I think the priority in that scenario is to add the power. Option number five is to add the power, level the wings, and then continue climbing and avoid the aircraft as necessary.
So your option five here, with kind of a hedge towards option four, is that you would level the wings first and then consider the maneuvering? Or tell me about that choice.
No matter what you do in the aircraft in this scenario, the change is not going to be immediate. It's not like you all of a sudden add the power and level the wings and you're starting to climb and you have good flying airspeed. There's a minute or two of, you know, having the airplane having to catch up with you. So you add the power, the nose rises. If you're continuing to try that angle of bank, you could potentially end up in a situation where you're getting slow with a high angle of attack. So when I say that I would start with number five and then morph toward number four, it would be, okay, you've already screwed up. Add the power, level the wings, make sure you're going to be at a safe flying speed, and if conditions allow at that point, to continue that turn once you've already established the climb and you're stable with your airspeed.
Tom?
I was originally thinking about option five on this for basically the same reasons, is just execute a climb straight ahead, but you're already in the turn. The airplane's already trending in the direction you want to go, and I thought about what Richard talked about, the second priority of clearing your flight path, and that's what's clear, that airspace over your runway. Yes, you'd have to be careful not to overshoot too much, but frankly, if you overshoot a little bit and you're climbing out anyhow, then you're really not conflicting with what's down below on that other runway's traffic pattern. I'm concerned about what might be on downwind that I don't know about on the other side of the airport.
Yeah, so if you level the wings and climb straight ahead here, you're going to go shooting off through the downwind leg, which might be embarrassing for one thing, right? You're coming into land and all of a sudden you're heading off in this random direction. But, you know, on the big sky concept and the fact that you've got these two other planes are also presumably looking for you, you also have a tower controller that's watching this play out. Kevin, if you were in the tower here, how on top of this are you going to be if a plane starts heading out straight across the opposite downwind?
It all depends, because there's any number of different things a tower controller could be doing at the same time, and they may or may not happen to have their eyes on you and the Cirrus out there on the right base at that moment. If they happen to be looking out the window at that moment and see you, then they'll be in a better position to do something about it. But probably with the other, with the Cessna that's on the opposite base, probably the tower controller is not going to have time to come up with a plan and relay that over the frequency in time to do anything to pull the airplanes apart. So the certainly over the airport where you were expected to be is more convenient for tower. It's more convenient for you, I think, in that that's already the clear path that's been sort of reserved for you. It's the expectation of where you're going to be going. So there aren't airplanes there. So yeah, for sure, I'd turn and over the runway you're supposed to be over.
Richard.
Yeah, just to piggyback on what Kevin said, in my mind, there's nothing the tower controller can do to help you in this scenario. You've created it. You're overshooting final. You know the traffic's there. So you've got to power up to make sure you maintain flying airspeed and then clear your flight path in whatever direction is the most convenient way to do that. And then now you've created a lot of work because he's going to have to move a lot of people around for you in the tower. But, you know, you can't rely on them to fix this problem for you.
Sarah.
One thing I'll add as well is that if you look at the Cirrus manual and just in go-rounds in general, you know, we do them at the airlines, I've done them a lot in GA, I can't really think of many scenarios in which the go-around requires a climbing go-around. And if you look at the Cirrus guidance, it actually states that apply full power while simultaneously leveling the wings. So I do agree that, I guess once again, it does depend on where you are in that base turn, but I think it's very important to level the wings, get flying airspeed, and then turn as soon as you possibly can to avoid conflicting with the other aircraft. I'm not saying, you know, climb straight out right into the downwind, but climb straight out maybe until you gain a couple hundred feet and then make that immediate turn.
Yeah, turning go-around is definitely an unusual thing that you don't really practice. Kevin?
I think the guidance is, while certainly well-intentioned, I don't think applies in this situation because I don't know that that guidance necessarily anticipates an airplane in your flight path. And so because of that, I'm still absolutely sticking with the turn and power up and get out of Dodge because you're just in a real bad spot in proximity to another airplane.
Wally, increasing bank without polling accomplishes nothing. Why do you want to accomplish nothing?
I didn't say that. Well, I've put myself in a tough situation here. It's a little intimidating arguing with a man who in part makes his living making videos flying upside down in an extra. But I'm going to do it anyway. My decision number three is influenced by my glider flying and glider instructing. We typically practice simulated rope breaks or tow plane power losses at 200 to 300 feet AGL. And we do that with two steps. Number one, we push forward and unload the airplane. And number two, we roll into a 45 to 60 degree bank turn. Now, power pilots are all very nervous about turning at low altitudes because their instructor has said, don't turn over 30 degrees when you're at a low altitude. I think that induces a lot of power pilots to tend to skid the turn because they're thinking about what that instructor told them. In the glider, we teach them to turn 60 degrees. But keep the nose well below the horizon. Don't even look at the airspeed. Simply keep your nose way below the horizon. Keep the airplane unloaded. Complete your 180-degree turn. Now roll out and you can adjust your pitch and airspeed. That's precisely what I would do in this circumstance. I'm already turning 30 degrees. It's pretty simple to roll that thing to 45 degrees. That will shorten my turn radius and lower the nose so I'm not loading the airplane. And I've got my right hand on a lever that'll give me 300 horsepower if I'm having any trouble with airspeed. Once I've completed that turn and I'm tracking back toward my runway, it's real easy to stabilize the airplane and land on this 6,000-foot runway. The reason I don't like the go-around, in either case, you've already encroached into the other pilot's airspace. You've overshot your airspace. Now, by continuing the turn and climbing, you're putting your nose and your wing up, and you're very apt to lose control or lose sight of that pilot. And I don't like that choice for that particular reason. You know, go-arounds are always good, but in this case, I think the go-around where you might lose sight of the pilot and you're already in his or her airspace is not the best solution for this scenario.
Dave?
You know, the losing sight portion is key here because this situation is so much easier if you got your eyes on the other airplane. And it's true that you're more likely to lose sight during the roll. But if the Cirrus pilot can keep the opposing traffic in sight during the roll, it's going to make this situation a lot less stressful and take out that unknown. And I could just imagine if the pilot does lose sight, the temptation to the sort of panic pull is going to be harder to suppress.
Part of my reaction to what you're saying, Wally, is why would you even try to salvage a landing here? Why not just go around? But it's an interesting point that go arounds, and I'm sure, Richard, you could speak to this. The base to final spin gets all the attention, but go arounds are where a lot of accidents happen.
Yeah, and I think this is just a simple way to solve the problem. You just crank the bank in, add a little power. Once you've cleared the collision hazard, you reestablish, stabilize your approach, and land. So for what it's worth, we do 180-degree turns without having up elevator. We do them strictly with bank, and they seem to turn around very well.
Your descent rate must increase a little bit when you do that, right?
A little. Typically in the glider, you have a little extra energy that you can use because the tow plane is typically flying faster than the glider needs to fly. But it's really a very simple maneuver. But when we do that the first time with power pilots, it takes a lot of briefing because they're very reluctant to make that steep bank. And if they don't make the steep bank, they're about 2 miles away from the runway by the time they complete the 180-degree turn.
Yeah, there's this idea, too, that goes around a lot, that you shouldn't bank more than 30 degrees in the pattern. Anybody have any thoughts on that? Sarah?
So I also fly gliders and got the opportunity to experience rope breaks in training. And what I will say is that, you know, gliders are kind of in a unique situation for that. It's very low wing loading. They're very high lift aircraft. You can throw a glider, like when you're thermaling, you can throw a glider into a 60 degree angle of bank pretty easily and stay within a thermal and start climbing. But you can't do that in a Cirrus. And a Cirrus, you know, has fairly high wing loading. It sinks like a rock when you start increasing the angle of bank. So while your technique does work in gliders, and it probably could work in this scenario, the question is, does an 8-hour checkout prepare somebody to fly a Cirrus at a high angle of bank low to the ground? And so just based on my personal experience with Cirrus aircraft, I'm not quite sure that I would ever encourage, especially a lower time pilot, to increase that angle of a bank low to the ground, unless it's something they've been trained on and experienced before. Because the very first time I experienced a rope break, it was like, oh my goodness, what's going on? I had to get used to that angle of bank, just like you were talking about. But trying that for the very first time in the pattern, I'm not quite sure would have such a good outcome.
What you're trying to avoid here, of course, is exceeding the critical angle of attack and not pulling too hard so as to do that. I mean, what if you had an angle of attack indicator on the dash in a sort of heads-up position, essentially telling you you're not pulling too much or you can pull this much? Dave, I know you've had some experience with AOA indicators. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I love AOA indicators for all sorts of reasons. I've never used one in this purpose to, like, in maneuvering to avoid another aircraft. But it's like, I think they can certainly aid in awareness. But I think this pilot's eyes would be more outside, not inside the cockpit looking for that. Also, you know, on the banking close to the ground portion, Richard organized a exercise where we practiced runway turnbacks, and you know, the guidance on that one was, okay, engine failure, count to four for the startle factor, roll into a 45-degree bank. You know, I'm very comfortable with unusual attitudes and steep banks, but it was really surprising to me how difficult it was to roll into a 45-degree bank. And in fact, when I reviewed the tape later, I was kind of horrified to see that it's like, I'm shallow. You know, I was rolling out 30 or 35 degrees. I wasn't really close to the target angle of bank that I was briefed on, you know, just before the flight. You know, even for a relatively high time GA pilot, that's hard to do.
Richard.
Something else that we talked about earlier that I want to stress is how to miss another airplane, right? It's counterintuitive, but when people see another airplane, what they'll typically do when they're surprised is bank up and pull away from it. And when you bank up, now you've lost sight of that airplane and you've lost your ability to miss it, really. Now you're just hoping that airplane misses you. So it's counterintuitive, but when you see an aircraft in close proximity to you, you really should bank towards it so you can keep your eye on it and make sure you miss it. It plays in this scenario because if you roll out and, you know, extend through the base, or if you do the go around like Dave suggested, you're keeping your ability to keep eye on traffic that you may need to miss because of a conflict you created.
So where does that go then? I mean, how do you keep that airplane in sight and avoid? What's your ground track going to be?
Who cares where your ground track is, right? So if you see an aircraft that's a conflict, you roll out to keep it in sight, and now your whole job is to miss that airplane. And once you miss it, now you worry about the rest of your cleared flight path and where you need to put your airplane for Class Bravo airspace or downwind or whatever. But your first priority is clear your flight path.
Yeah, I think there's a psychological thing here too, though. Like, you know, so much of what you do, it comes down to instinct in this moment. But there's got to be a strong urge not to like go shooting off across the downwind. I mean, that's not going to be your instinct here, right, Kevin?
I very much agree with the thought of the part about aiming towards the airplane to miss them, aiming for their tail, aiming for just behind them, or. In general, if you're aiming at an airplane where the airplane is right now, well, that's not where they're going to be in a second when you get there. So there's definitely a lot of value to that. But in the scenario, I'm not sure that we have room, since we've already started the base to final turn. I'm not sure we have room to then turn in the opposite direction and maybe be aiming behind where that airplane's going to be.
Tom.
Yeah. You're a little bit higher than the opposing traffic already in this scenario. The Cirrus is higher than the 172. You're overshooting, but you had delayed beginning your descent. So you're already a little bit higher, and that's good. You have a reasonable expectation the Cessna is going to continue to descend, so that's good. Even if you leveled the wings and did a go-around straight ahead, you're in the classic low wing, high wing scenario. You probably will not have that airplane in sight at that point. And so I tend to think that if you continued the turn and you did your go around down the runway, that even at your lowest go around speed in the Cirrus, you're going to be flying faster than that Cessna is on its final approach. And you're climbing away from the threat. So this is a situation where, in order to keep that airplane in sight, you wouldn't miss straight ahead. You'd actually have to turn to the left to keep it in visual, keep in visual contact of that airplane. You'd be almost doing a go around on an upwind heading, or a downwind heading.
So Richard says flight path doesn't matter. You're trying to miss this airplane. That's your top priority. A turn to the left would put you into Oakland's airspace.
Okay.
And you're right below what I guess would be their departure path. Okay. Does that make a difference in this moment?
Yes, it would, because you're creating any number of other conflicts that way. But my point was that if you continued the turn and began your go around down runway heading, you're already going to be above and faster than the airplane. So at this point, trying to maneuver to keep it in sight is not necessarily going to give you the separation you would have in this situation.
Wally.
Pardon me, Tom, but I don't have that view that you're above the plane. Mm-hmm. That runway's traffic pattern is 200 feet higher than the pattern we're on. If we're both turning base at the same place, that runway is displaced farther down than the runway we're landing on. So the fact is, I think we would be, that plane would be higher than we would be. And that's one of my objections to the go-around. And the turn and the climb is that we would be climbing right toward that airplane. Maybe I have that.
But we don't have an exact fix on where this plane is, but they're on the other base.
If we both turn base at the same time, theoretically he should be a bit higher if he's on a normal glide slope, because his runway is displaced a bit farther down than ours.
Yeah, that makes sense. Sarah.
I don't disagree. I think that you make excellent points about trying to keep the other traffic in sight, because once again, we have two threats here. However, my argument for number five, possibly morphing into four, is that the more immediate threat at this exact moment is the potential to stall or spin the aircraft. And therefore, you know, making sure that you have the other traffic in sight and determining which way to turn is important. But I think the most immediate threat here is to gain that airspeed, start a positive rate of climb, and ensure that you're not going to put yourself in a stall spin scenario.
Tom.
And at least as important is giving it the adequate rudder it needs, because you're already in a right turn, consequently some right rudder, and then you're going to give this thing full power. Need a lot of right rudder in a go-around in a Cirrus or that class of airplane anyhow, and add to that the right turn. So yes, it would require a good angle of attack control, airspeed control, but you'd also have to really emphasize the rudder control on this.
And as Dave points out, push, even though you're trying to initiate a climb, you're probably going to have to push. I mean, these are counterintuitive inputs that you need to make here. Dave.
You know, my formal education was in journalism, and we have a a saying called burying the lead, you know, and I think we're kind of burying the lead here, because how did we get in this situation? It's like we got in this situation because this pilot's not paying attention to flying his own airplane. And if only the Cirrus pilot had been a little more focused on positioning his own airplane and flying predictably and precisely, this scenario could have been avoided. Situational awareness is a wonderful thing. Knowing what's going on around us, having a mental picture of that is a fantastic skill to develop. But, you know, a pilot's first responsibility is to fly his or her own airplane.
So let's back this up a little bit then, because the factors really stacked up against this pilot for an overshoot. We've got a lower than normal traffic pattern, a tailwind on the base leg, a right-hand pattern, a faster plane that the pilot's probably behind on a short leg, which might put them behind also, distraction of this other traffic. All these factors add up to an overshoot. So what could have been done to avoid that in the first place? And one of these is the low pattern, which if you're an instrument instructor, you've seen this on circling approaches a bunch, right? Tom, you do a lot of instrument instructing, right?
Well, I do. And I, interestingly enough, in doing transition training in bonanzas, we show them the spiraling tendency of the airplane, which is the tendency of the airplane to go into an increasingly steepening and rapid rate of vertical descent when the bank angle gets steep. And then I put that in context. That's one of the contexts that I put that into with people is, you know, we talk about this is what happens if you go VFR and IMC, and also that you can avoid that by not going VFR and IMC. But the reality, as I tell them, that this is what happens when people get distracted in the traffic pattern and they allow the bank angle to get too steep and they don't properly manage the vertical descent. So it takes a lot of finesse between bank angle and power so you don't increase the angle of attack there. But I actually do point that out to folks that that if the bank angle gets steep, it's going to start to descend, and that's going to be start off a cascading potential set of errors.
Sarah?
One thing that's kind of subtle on here that hasn't been really focused on a lot is also the tailwind component on base. I do a lot of check rides, and I can usually tell if the wind's coming out a certain direction if the person will overshoot on that circling approach. And it's really important in the backcountry, especially when you have a fairly technical approach where you have to keep it in tight or something like that. And a lot of times, if I'm training a student, I'll be like, well, hey, you've got a tailwind on base or you've got a headwind on base. And that, to me, also makes a big deal. And that should have been briefed as a threat that, hey, I've got a 10-knot tailwind on base. Maybe I should start my turn a little bit sooner.
Yeah, the geometry of this low pattern, right? If you're using the same sight pictures, if you're looking down on the runway on downwind at the same angle, you are quite a bit closer to the runway than you think you are. And that leads me, every instrument instructor has seen that probably on practically every instrument student's first circling approach, the overshoot from base to final. Wally?
Well, just to defend my position just a bit more, I see the threat different maybe than other people. I see the threat of the midair, the greater threat here than the stall spin. Even Dave commented in his analysis that at a 45-degree bank, you have way more, plenty adequate stall margin in this airplane. So that's the other influence in my decision. I think that clears up the greater threat.
So just a subtlety here in this scenario to me that's important. This pilot's coming out of a 172, right, and stepped up to a Cirrus, first high-performance checkout. One of the mistakes I see when people do that is they always, when they have to add power, they go full power. They think it's a binary throttle. It's either full power or idle, right? And so I think on this go-around, a comment was made earlier that, you know, establish full power. Not necessarily full power. When you get in a airplane that's as high performance as like a Bonanza or a Cirrus, power as required is a really important step here. And adding that full power, you may need it, but I would start with power as required and not be so inclined to just jam the power forward.
So if you do anticipate all these factors that might lead you to overshoot, what might you do differently? You know, do you try not to square off the base to final turn, start it early and make a shallow turn that you can steepen then if you need to? Tom?
It sounds to me that really what set off this whole chain here was that the pilot flew the downwind too close to the runway, which is usually the opposite of the problem we have. But maybe it would be more correct to say that more likely the wind had blown the pilot closer to the runway while the pilot was trying to maintain adequate spacing but didn't compensate for the crosswind. So one of the things you might do to compensate, recognizing that you're going to have this tailwind on the base leg, is to fly just slightly farther out from the runway to give yourself more time to make that turn.
Mm-hmm. Dave?
And regarding your earlier point about the low altitude pattern, I think the lower the altitude of the pattern, the easier it is to fly, because you notice subtle changes. I mean, there's more relative movement between when you're climbing, you see that. If you're just descending, same thing. I was really surprised one day. I was watching a bunch of Navy jets practicing, doing field carrier landing practice, and they were flying their patterns at 600 feet AGL. And that was standard for this, you know, supersonic fighter. And I just thought, and that really stuck with me, because I was asking one of the pilots afterwards about why so low. You know, 1,000 feet is what we fly in GA, piston single, 1,000 feet AGL. And this pilot was making the point that it's easier low. You know, you notice the changes right away looking out the window.
I'm not sure I agree with that. I'm not sure I agree that.
Have you ever flown a jet close to the ground?
Fair enough. I'm not sure I agree with that. That lower patterns are easier to fly. I don't agree with that. I just think having that extra vertical turning room gives you so many more options when you fly a pattern at 1,000 feet versus 500 or 600 feet. Like Sarah, I fly in the backcountry a lot, and you have to and you should fly low patterns back there in some cases. But in general, I'm just not sure.
They're easier to fly precisely. Mm. If you're looking for precision, lower is easier because the relative changes are more apparent.
Kevin?
I think one way to take some of the need for precision out of this scenario is to start that base to final turn a little bit earlier than you normally would if it was a single runway, given that there's parallel runways. And I think that's one way to stack the deck in your favor to ensure that you're not going to overshoot, particularly if you got a tailwind on that base leg.
Yeah, that makes sense. Even all these extra factors aside, just the fact that there are close parallel runways, that should be front of your mind as you fly the pattern. Yeah.
What should be front of our mind, all of us, Ryan, is it is the most precarious scenario for mid-air collisions in the pattern. They happen most with parallel offsetting runways. So anytime pilots go into that scenario, we ought to just all be aware that this is the highest risk scenario for a traffic pattern collision.
I want to back this up one step further to the flight that this pilot chose to make as a newly checked out Cirrus pilot. It seems innocent enough. It's a perfect VFR day. Short hops between airports, get some experience going A to B and entering the pattern and landing. But there's a lot of work on these short flights too. And maybe Sarah, you can speak to, you know, as an airline pilot, when a new captain has an IOE period, right? Initial operating experience, where they have some limitations. I mean, how does that play in your mind at all when you're thinking about what a pilot like this should be doing for their first flight, setting similar limitations on yourself? Or was this reasonable?
I think it's very reasonable to say, okay, I'm new to the aircraft, and set your own personal minimums. And actually, there's a checklist out there where you can say, okay, I've got 8 hours of experience in this airplane. But a lot of the limitations they impose on the airline pilots have to do with weather minimums, visibility, crosswinds, runway contamination, things like that. It's generally not airmanship things, because airmanship is something that you've been trained on, that you've been evaluated on, and then once again, you know, through OE, you've been again evaluated and signed off again. That being said, short hops, especially in a complex aircraft, are challenging. They do increase the workload. Anytime that you increase the workload on a pilot, you increase the chances of them making a mistake. You increase the probability of errors. So from even a threat and error management standpoint, those short legs definitely increase the workload, increase the amount of threats that a pilot has to deal with, and it can lead to errors such as this one that could eventually lead to an undesired aircraft state or a situation where you're having to make a decision between a bad and a bad bad, you know, because obviously prevention would have been number one in this scenario. But all of these options given that the pilot has in this exact scenario, it's like choosing which one is the least risk and least dangerous.
Kevin.
I agree with that thought process for complex airplanes in general, but I'm not sure that the Cirrus necessarily qualifies that way. And by that, I mean, it's a fixed gear airplane. You don't have a prop lever. Really, the only configuration changes that you're making are your trim settings and flap settings. And other than that, there's really not a whole lot to do in the Cirrus for going from one airport to another close-in airport. So as far as this pilot's choice of a route and going to airports, I don't think it's more than should be expected of this pilot.
Sarah.
I agree with you. I don't think there's additional steps involved, like having to lower the gear or having to do the prop lever. But the aircraft is significantly faster than a Cessna 172. And I find that most people get themselves into trouble when they get behind the aircraft. And it's really easy to get behind it when now all of a sudden you're doing 170 knots as compared to 107. And I think that that can end up as an increased workload in an aircraft such as a Cirrus.
I want to go back to you, Wally, here, and not pulling in the turn, right?
Yeah.
Because there is this idea that the elevator is the primary turn control.
Well, right? All the airplane books I have at my house tell me that the angle of bank and the airspeed control the radius of turn. So, you know, I don't understand how to fly airplanes upside down like some of the people here at the table, but in the turns I make, angle of bank and airspeed are what changes my radius.
Yeah, I find that when I pull on the pole, the rate of turn increases when the plane is banked. You know, it's interesting. Wally brought up the aerobatics and then the extra. You know, all these controls are pretty much independent. You know, there's no control linkages between the rudders and the ailerons, for example. And that one to me is just kind of the purest case, because it's like, okay, you want to roll into a 60-degree bank, you've got a 60-degree bank, but until you pull, you have no turn. And so, obviously the Cirrus is not an extra, but it's like the same principle to me holds true, that it's the vertical component of lift.
Sarah.
And I actually agree with you, Wally, that we should not be afraid of banking the aircraft. You know, just like with gliders, or even if you're doing spray flying, ag flying, we should not be afraid of angles of bank, but we should respect them and realize that increasing that angle of a bank, even if you're not doing much with the elevator, that there's always a potential that if you somehow do load the aircraft or the wing a little bit more than you expect, you could end up in a situation where you've increased the stall speed enough to end up in a bad situation.
I agree. But I don't think that's the case in this scenario.
Kevin?
I think just to kind of build on that, that highlights the utility of getting some training in an aerobatic airplane or a glider. And it doesn't even have to be enough for a rental checkout or a certificate or anything like that. But just some stick time, a little bit of experience in either or both of those things could help you out with any of these types of situations where you're in maneuvering flight and you need to quickly make something happen to not hit another airplane.
Yeah, and that sort of training can build instincts as to what you can and can't get away with, what will and won't work. Because we can sit here and talk about, you know, we can bank this much, we can pull this much. If we go around, there are these sort of counterintuitive control inputs that we need to make. But in this moment where you don't have time to think about it, it's all going to come down to what are your pilot instincts, right? And these accidents, these, you know, whether they're mid-airs or base to final spins, these things continue to happen. And if you don't take a break in your regular A to B flying to get some practice on these things, to get some extra training, then you're not going to have any occasion to hone those instincts until a situation where it actually matters.